what was going on. And Mac had a right to know, too. Either they were a team or they weren't. Clearly they weren't. I didn't say you could call me Danny. Or honey. Only people who don't keep secrets from me get to call me those things. It's Jada to you. Then she turned the warmth back on and said to Mac, Are you okay? Scowling, Lore stalked to the desk, punched buttons, slammed the panel closed, then moved back to the door where he stood legs wide, powerful arms folded across his chest. Been better, she said, with a note of weariness in her voice. Her gaze dipped to Jada's cuff as she moved into the office and joined her near the desk. When she reached for her, Jada stiffened, but Mac only caught a stray curl of her hair and smoothed it behind her ear. Then she said, I missed you. Jada shifted uncomfortably. Dude, space, you just saw me last night. A slow smile curved Mac's lips. I never thought the day would come I'd actually be happy to have you dude me. I meant before that. I'm glad you're back. Glad we're back. I missed us, she said simply. Her gaze dropped to the cuff again. The ZEWs are still out there, and so is the sweeper. The cuff's what keeps them from being able to track you. Don't take it off. Jada nodded. And listen to Barons, do what he says. He's got a plan. Jada inclined her head. And for heaven's sake, try talking to Riordan sometime. Have an actual conversation. I think he'd do anything you wanted if you just asked him. Nicely. Barons is the same way. Difficult to manage, yet manageable if you know the right buttons to push.
Barons is right here, Miss Lane. And Barons doesn't have buttons.
Barons said stiffly, and Lore snickered. Jada glanced at Barons, wondering if he'd told Mac what they were planning to do. Or were they supposed to take her by surprise? She discarded that possibility. Barons would have already given her one of the stones if that were his intention. From the way Mac was doling out the big sister advice, she suspected she knew, but said anyway, You're on board with this? As she searched Mac's gaze. Green eyes darkened to pools of obsidian. Not a fucking chance in hell, you stupid cunt. And Mac vanished. 20. I was hungry, and it was your world. Avil. Her name was Zara. His was a symbol too complex for her mind to absorb. She was one of her race's revered healers. He was a god-king, half mad from long solitude. Tethered to something much vaster than mere rock and soil, acolyte to the great, wise soul thing that pervaded the universes, Zara was connected to all, bound to none. She was wild and free, a powerful witch of the forests and stars and seas, her every breath filled with joy. Her name was a prayer, uttered by her people in times of need. She always came. A fevered child to be tended, a wounded animal to mend, a tree damaged by storm. She healed, nurtured, repaired, and when necessary, helped those whose time it was to become the next thing. Death was but a doorway to another life. She could see the souls of the living, their colors, shapes, and sizes, ailments and strengths. She could feel the soul of the all. Everything fit precisely where it was, had been, and was going. And if being bound to none was sometimes lonely, on nights when she peeked through windows as her people nestled down and made love, and children and futures, and mating season came for the animals she protected, being connected to the all made it worth the price. Or so she thought. Until he came. Avil shook her head sharply, splintering ice with the motion. It tinkled like shards of broken glass when it crashed to the floor in the king's black velvet darkness. No, she whispered. The moment she'd stepped into the mirror, it seemed to absorb her, drawing her into a memory bubble planted deep within its silvery interior. And suddenly, she was somewhere else, racing through a misty, triple-canopied forest, laughing, and being chased by a flock of brilliant, winged, inquisitive Temuras, darting through the leaves. Somewhere she'd known. Somewhere she'd rued ever leaving. She'd recognized the place, with the fundamental essence of her being. She'd been born there, fashioned from the elements and minerals and waters of the planet itself. The king had brought the Temuras to her world, the first gift he'd ever given her. Had he chosen anything else, she'd not have been so easily disarmed. There'd been no material goods for which she'd hungered, but he'd selected brilliantly winged living creatures, birds with crimson and gold beaks that were wont to echo odd words and phrases, sometimes stringing them together in ways that seemed to almost make sense, and sang an exquisite melody, but only at sunrise and sunset, as if they, like her, saluted the morning and welcomed the night. Impossible for one such as she to resist. She'd been touched, beguiled, delighted by his gift. She'd thought he chose them for her because he, too, loved the small things of the world. "Zara," she whispered, cracking the ice again. She glanced around the vast, starlit chamber that was twice the size of an ancient Roman Colosseum, its floor scattered with exotically spiced, velvety dark petals. Tiny black diamonds floated on the air, midnight fireflies winking with blue flame. Between towering slabs of black ice that stretched to a starlit night sky, an enormous, velvet-draped bed filled most of the chamber. On the far wall, a blue-black fire sent tendrils licking up to the ceiling, where they exploded in a fantastic nebula shimmering with blue vapors. There was only one other piece of furniture in the room. A small table, upon which perched a translucent beaker, filled with a golden liquid, steaming at the narrow mouth. Gathering her cloak around her, she crushed spicy petals beneath her feet as she glided toward it, feeling an unshakable sense of deft manipulation that chafed her. Next to the beaker was a sheaf of thick vellum with three words on it. "Dare you remember?" She'd been wrong. He'd known she would go through his mirror. Why hadn't he simply incarcerated her there to begin with, and poured whatever potion he'd chosen down her unwilling throat? She'd been his concubine. Who knows how many potions she'd willingly drunk for him? Who could say how they'd changed her? Yet he'd forced nothing upon her, merely set her on the path of choice. A fluttering high in the corner of the starry sky caught her eye, at too great a distance to make out detail. She doubted anything was in his chamber at this hour by chance. Turning her back on the beaker, she moved to the edge of the bed and gazed up, waiting motionless for so long she froze solid again. She'd heard their love had burned so fiercely there'd been nothing they wouldn't do for each other, that they'd traveled the great all together, spinning breathtaking new worlds. She'd heard. She had no memory of it, nor did she want it. She wanted no part of him. She knew who she was now, and that her past had indeed been stolen from her. It was enough. As she shattered the coating of ice, the fluttering thing at the starry ceiling dove for her, its jewel-toned wings spreading in a wide, brilliant span, bold and rich against the sleek, black walls of the king's boudoir. The Temura settled lightly, with a soft rustling of wings, on her left shoulder, and began to peck playfully at the fur trim of her cloak. Damn the bastard. His idea of renewing a courtship, no doubt. Reminding her of their beginnings. Trying to seduce her into wanting to know more. As the Temura hooked its talons into the fabric of her cloak, they iced together, cracking only when she finally stirred herself to return to the beaker. The sheaf of vellum now bore new words. "For the light court, the cauldron of forgetting, because they are fools and will use it. For the dark court, the elixir of remembering, because they are fearless and will choose it. She'd heard myths that such an elixir existed. It was claimed that even those who chose not to drink from the cauldron lost memories over the eons. The elixir allegedly cleared the cobwebs of disuse from the mind and restored each and every one to its proper time and place. It was said the ancient king drank it daily, refusing to yield even a single memory, and that this infinity of knowledge contributed to his fits of madness. Among the Fae there were stories about everything, making it impossible to discern fable from fact. She never believed the elixir was real, but she'd been wrong about many things. She stared bitterly down at the beaker, and its golden, misting contents, absently stroking the Temura on her shoulder, which clucked as it began to nibble delicately at the lobe of her ear. She'd been torn from her life as the mortal concubine, turned Fae, then transformed into their queen. Why? Had someone groomed her to become the queen because she'd been deemed suitably malleable? And if she disappointed her groomer, would he simply erase her memory again? She'd had her memories stripped away, not once, as she'd feared, 60,000 years ago, but obviously multiple times, given how long ago she'd been the king's concubine. Her very existence, everything she was, had been thieved from her, repeatedly. How many lifetimes had she lost, only to be left priding herself on being the ruler of a race that was not even hers? If she believed the king, Cruz had done this to her, and she would never have left her lover of her own volition. If she believed the king, Cruz had forced her to write a note decrying the king as a monster, and if she drank from the beaker, she would be in love with him again. She didn't want to be in love with him again. Love had made her a fey pawn, to be battered back and forth across their manipulative chessboard, damaged, altered, changed. Look, she's a pawn. No, she's a queen. Oh, wait, she's a pawn again. What say we make her a rook next? And for what? To end up here. Alone. A woman whose existence had been so fractured by magic elixirs, she no longer knew who she was. Narrowing her eyes, she studied the beaker. She had no desire to accept anything the king offered. But if she didn't drink it, she would spend the rest of her life, which might be considerably shorter than she'd expected if the song of making wasn't found, as no more than she was right now, a bitter fae queen who resented the mantle she carried, resented the very people she'd been appointed to rule. If the earth died, she would die as that woman, wondering, never knowing. She sighed. On her shoulder, the Temura clucked with seeming sympathy. Zara, she murmured. The Temura cocked its head and gave her a quizzical glance.
Ah, Zara,
it squawked, as if agreeing. It had been Zara's joy that had drawn the king to her. Her passion, her wildness, an unrestrained immersion in everything she did. That, too, had been tucked within the memory of the mirror. She'd never known such buoyancy of being. Not that she could recall. She couldn't even quite fathom it. Could only examine its weft and weave, a dispassionate observer. What good could lost memories of such feelings possibly do her? She was fey now, capable of only shallow sensation. It might do no more than torment her with dim impressions of a life she could never feel again. Which was preferable? Bitterness or an eternal sense of loss? Wouldn't both result in bitterness? The concubine had not wanted to be turned fey. When a mortal became fey, it lost its soul. Zara had prized her soul above all else, and now had none. She picked up the beaker and turned it in her hand, this way and that, eyeing the golden contents, the iridescent mist seeping from the narrow mouth, analyzing pros and cons, incentive and disincentive, reaching an impasse every time. In the end, she turned off her mind and made the decision with what mild emotion was left to her. She tipped the beaker to her lips and drank. 21. I am the knuckle. Bow down and buckle. Mac. The eviction from my body is instantaneous. The moment I hear myself speaking words I'm not saying and never would, I'm seized by the she-sadoo's gargantuan will, scraped from my body and stuffed back into my box. Never think me weak, the she-sadoo purrs. I got you, babe. Always. As it crams me into the cramped, dark interior and slams the lid, I think, bullshit. There is no secret compartment inside my body that I can be stuffed into. Just like there never actually was a book, open or closed, inside me. The she-sadoo painted two elaborate illusions for me, and did one hell of a sales job. I infused both illusions with my belief, and was thereby imprisoned. Not by the book. By my own gullibility. Belief is reality. In here, disembodied, I apprehend that truth in a moment of exquisite clarity and realize it's the keystone of existence. Not just mine, everyone's. What's the surest way to be victimized? Believe yourself a victim. To win? Believe yourself a champion. I believe myself a body, kick the lid off my non-existent box with it, and the boundaries around me crumble into the nothing it really is. I stand tall. My fury boundless for too many reasons to count, but I'll start with. I'd been basking in a warm exchange with Jada, the first one in what seemed a small, painful eternity. She'd let me call her Danny, and deep in her eyes, I'd glimpsed a welcome flash of that old familiar fire. My girl was in there, and getting closer to coming out. Then my mouth had called her a stupid cunt. Yep, that's enough to thoroughly piss me off. I hate that word. No idea why, I just do. And the instant hurt in her eyes, the unguarded emotion that preceded her intellect processing that the book had taken me over again, had utterly slayed me. I have no doubt she'll understand I didn't mean it, but that's not the point. It just leads me to my second point. My psychopathic intruder deceived me. Again. How many times will I fall victim to its endless mindfuck? What is wrong with me? It's not like it can cast a spell on me. I'm it. It's me. It can only try to control me with deceit and lies, and it keeps working. I expand my awareness, feather into my limbs, settle behind my eyes, and look out. I may be free of the box, but the book has full control of my body. I can feel my limbs, peer out through my eyes, but I can't control any of it. I'm a passive, straight-jacketed observer. My hand is around Jada's throat, shaking her violently. I can't see it because it's invisible, but I feel my fingers deep in the flesh of her throat as she dangles a foot above the floor. Right. I called her a cunt, and now I'm strangling her. My fury multiplies. I permitted you to stay and watch her die, the she-sadoo gloats. Permitted my ass. I'm here, and I'm not leaving, and her dying is never happening. Danny is what I opened the book for, and I will destroy it for her, too. I gather all my will and focus it on the hand around her throat. Let go, let go, let go, I will with the full force of my rage. Never, the she-sadoo thunders back, flattening me, crushing me paper thin, nearly blasting me from my passive presence in my limbs. On Jada's throat, my fingers tighten cruelly. She chokes, clawing at my arm. How can the book be so strong when it was recently so weak? I focus again on my hand, zero in on a single finger, stoking my rage. If I can affect even one finger, that'll prove to me that I can... A strong arm hooks my throat from behind and yanks hard, choking off my air. The book instantly releases my grip on Jada, realizing belatedly that although it had made my body invisible, suspending her in the air had given its position away. I seize upon the fact with interest. It's fallible. It makes mistakes. The book uses my lips to shape soundless words, and suddenly a dozen duplicate versions of me spring into existence, cramming the office with identical Max. I realize dimly that I look like hell, assuming we all look alike. Lore and Fade go into instant battle mode, attacking versions of me.
I've got the real one. She's still invisible.
Barons roars. That may be true, but the other Max are fighting like banshees, leaping on Lore's and Fade's backs, kicking, punching. The book is either capable of throwing glamour that actually has substance, or weaving a highly sophisticated illusion of it that convinces the others they're actually interacting with it. Whichever it is, the end result is the same. Time seems to suspend a moment while I apply this information to my sister, Alina. Was she, too, nothing more than one of these types of illusions? Never back from the dead at all, merely an elaborate ruse that fooled everyone? If I questioned one of the duplicate Max, would they, too, be fully programmed with pertinent information like Alina was? Now that the book had what it wanted, did that mean Alina had already ceased to exist? The book doesn't fight the arm around my throat. Instead, it stabs viciously back past my ribcage, and I feel the spear sink into Barron's body. It must have seized it from Jada's thigh sheath at the same time it grabbed her by the throat. In the instant that, stunned by my transition, she'd hesitated and didn't kick up into the slipstream fast enough. I'd missed that part because I was occupied destroying my box and discovering my power. I hear a soft hiss of breath. Then Barron's growls and his hold on my neck loosens. The book ducks and twists from its grasp, scrambles away and plasters back against the wall. I try desperately to turn my eyes to the left to see how badly I've injured Barron's, but the book doesn't cooperate. From the corner of my eye, I see him move, lunge to his feet again, and heave a sigh of relief. The last time I'd driven my spear into him, he died. Suddenly, the mini-Macs go motionless and begin to chime an ear-splitting melody that is so wrong, so painful, that everyone in the office, including the book, claps hands to ears, wincing. The hellish crystalline symphony builds to an excruciating crescendo. I feel the horrific vibration deep in my bones. The glass walls of the office rumble and begin to crack with the sound of thunder rolling. The floor beneath me begins to shudder, and abruptly it collapses beneath us in an explosion of glass. Clawing air, I plunge to the dance floor below and slam into the floor hard. My body rolls, scrambles up in the midst of a tangle of humans and Seely who trample one another in a desperate dash to escape the shower of glass. Barron's hits the floor a dozen feet away, landing on top of a club patron brutally decapitated by a sheet of jagged fallen glass. Slipping in blood, he bounds to his feet and roars,
"Where the fuck did she go?"
Lore crashes into a knot of screaming women, and Fade slams into a table next to him, shattering it with his weight.
"She vanished again,"
Lore snarls. "Find her," Jada shouts from somewhere in the slipstream. "She took the spear back. We have to stop her before it's too late." "They'll never find me. I'm invisible. And the book already has me halfway to the door." As I'm unwillingly steered into the night, I try once again to exert control over my body. Furiously, I will my feet to stop moving, cast away the spear. For whatever reason, having the spear makes me more dangerous. That's reason enough to get rid of it. Nothing happens. I can't influence my body at all. What am I doing wrong? What's the missing ingredient? And what didn't Barron's tell me? Why didn't he warn me that the book has some deadly plan it's trying to implement? Perhaps I could figure out some way to stop it, if I could figure out how to move. I shake my inner head and sigh. I know why he didn't tell me. The same reason he didn't tell me who I killed. He didn't want to give me more to worry about. He figured I had enough on my plate. And I do. Either that or he anticipated what I didn't. That the book was simply playing me again. And any information he shared with me, the book might get too. And it was playing me. How did it con me so easily?
Why did I risk letting Barons near me in the first place? I know the Shisadu is the ultimate deceiver. Why did I blithely allow Barons to take me straight back into the middle of the people I cared about? I should have known better. Why do I keep falling for its deceptions? And why is my belief not enough to override the book's beliefs? How does its force of will continue to supersede mine? It occurs to me the answer must lie within the very definition of its nature, and mine, so I begin to tally the differences. I'm good, it's evil. I'm compassionate, it's savage. I love, it hates. No, I can't even say it hates. Just that it has an enormous superiority complex from which stem two mildly emotional states. Rage, when impeded, and glee, when full of itself for attaining one of its goals. It's not capable of any true degree of... A non-existent light bulb pops on in my non-existent head. That's it. I buy into its deceptions every time because of my emotions. Love, hope, desire, fear, doubt, confusion blind me. And it keeps winning because it has none. How do I fight it? I'd asked Barons.
Become it,
he'd said. I thought he'd meant I should participate to some degree in its violence and savagery, deceive it into believing I'd succumbed fully to its influence, then strike when at least expected it. But that's not what he'd meant at all. He'd meant become it. Just like it. We are desire, lust, greed, and the path we choose to supremacy, the book had said as it feigned falling asleep. The Shisadu was appetite and ambition, nothing more, capable of only vague impressions of feelings, leaving it free to coolly dissect and analyze everything around it. While I was preoccupied with my emotions, the book had nothing in its mind at all but a hunger to figure out how to exploit me. Its path to supremacy was unimpeded by the slightest distraction. What an enormous advantage! And so long as I felt, it would always have that advantage. Always be able to remain one step, or 10, ahead of me, merely by keeping me in an emotional tizzy, too confused to focus fully. Emotion diluted my focus. I snarl slightly. Fucker. It used that very thing it lacked against me. At least now I understood why the past few months had been such a wasteland of foggy confusion. It was always subtly dicking with me. Who can say what subliminal messages it fed me, whispered in my inner ear, perhaps even as I slept? I may never know to what extent it has been able to eavesdrop on me and tinker with my internal hardware, but I do know one thing. I will never be myself so long as this tick is latched into my skin. As the book passes the tumbled east wall of Chester's, it spies a man and a woman, walking slowly, holding hands. Invisible, they don't even know I'm there, until the book grabs both their heads and, muttering spells, crashes their skulls together, melding their faces at the cheeks. Then it shoves them together more, joining them at the hips, ribs, thighs. They scream as they're slowly, inexorably fused skin to skin, bone to bone, into an awkwardly conjoined twin. Then the book just walks away, leaving the grotesque pair tottering about in the street, screaming. It laughs with my mouth, turns my head and glances back, purrs a spell, and instantly the gruesome twin is turned inside out. Intestines and organs where their skin once was. Mouths, ears, and eyes trapped within. The macabre heap collapses to the cobbled pavement, where their now external hearts pulse wetly. The book leaves them like that, alive. Walks away, giggling. The old me would have been overcome with horror. And while I was reeling, the book would no doubt have driven another knife into me and twisted. The new me observes with dispassionate calm. Distraction, irrelevant, discern its true aim, impede it. After a long moment in which I make no response, it probes, Michaela, in a sing-song voice. I know you're in there. Ta-ta-tee for two, and two for tea. Me for me, and you for me. Did you like that one? I did it just for you. I say nothing, pretending not to care. You can't fool me. You bleed for everything. You were born to be bled, born to be ridden, until there's nothing left of you but bones. Broken horses, die, die, die. It had always mocked me for caring. While goading, pushing, prodding, trying to make me feel even more emotion. Don't talk to it, the dreamy-eyed guy had said. Never talk to it. More recently, he'd cautioned, it's not about eating the candy, it's about giving away words, even that broody-ass poet's. He told me over and over, do not engage, not even with rhymes to drown it out. Perhaps there were many fey things one should never, ever open a dialogue with. After all, how had the book finally worn me down? By going silent. Silence can't be interpreted. It can't be anticipated. It gives away nothing. And in most people, prolonged silence instills unease. We fill it up with the very best or worst of our imagination. As Riordan said, the wise man is the silent one. Each time I'd conversed with the Shisadu, I'd leaked information about myself. What mattered to me, what didn't, intentionally or not. The book had learned something about me every time I opened my mouth. Perhaps it had even learned from my dreams. Barons was right. I'd been its willing victim. By my consent, I'd engaged, interacted, let it gaslight and disorient me until I had no clue which end was up. Then once I'd lost my bearings, I'd been easy to point whichever direction it wanted. If I had a body, I would draw my first deep breath since the moment it evicted me. I understand now. I know what I have to do. Anger was never the answer. It was the precise wrong approach. I stop looking out from behind eyes I can't blink, detach from limbs I can't control, and retreat into myself. Eliminating all distraction so I can give 100% focus to my aim. I sink deep into the belly of my body, draw in small and fetal. It can make itself invisible. I can too. I believe myself undetectable to the Shisadu. I devote all my will to that thought, then get down to ferreting out and stripping away my emotion. Peeling myself down to only those things that are ferocity, power, and will. Distantly, the book continues to taunt me, but I tune it out. I can't stop it, so there's no point in paying attention to it. I must do my work and return ready. It takes time. It's slow going at first. But the more I butcher myself, the simpler it becomes. I focus like a laser. Slicing away every ounce of compassion and mercy I possess. I obliterate kindness, love, laughter, and joy. I scorch doubt and fear for my being. Every shade of terror, anger, frustration, and rage gets burned away. I gouge out confusion, which is so frequently an emotional state, not a mental one. I eradicate guilt, shame, even mild consternation. I go even further. I char hope into ash. I don't need it. Hope postulates a tomorrow. There is only this moment, and the one that focuses most fully on this moment will win. I singe even desire from my essence, as that too could be used against me. I hack ruthlessly at the finest parts of me, those things that make me feel, those things that make me alive, something the book can never be, and it knows it. And it frustrates it to be so empty, so it tortures and destroys everyone around it, until I too am cold and dead, savagery, wed to resolution. I find it startlingly pleasant to strip myself down to this unfeeling core, as if it's always been there, waiting for me. I have a skeleton inside my skeleton, and it's made of pure titanium. I know what it is, where it came from. The rape of the Unseelie princes. They'd made me feel powerless, helpless, a useless piece of trash to be desecrated and crushed beneath their heel when they were finished amusing themselves with me, as if I were a plastic Barbie doll to be violated and broken and tossed away. And as I'd laid there in the gutter, seeing myself through their eyes, as the complete irrelevance they'd considered me, I'd hungered to be the predator they were, the one standing, the one destroying. I'd thought they'd destroyed me. They hadn't. They'd made me stronger. A beast of pure instinct and savagery had been born in the gutter that day. I'd been afraid of it. I was no longer. Barons was right. There is a monster inside me. And she's beautiful.
22. She is benediction. She is addicted to thee. Avil. The elixir of remembering worked in similar fashion to the passing of the true magic from the Fae Queen to her successor, with three significant differences. 1. The elixir restored memories, while the passage of the matriarchal power contained no memories, just magic and lore. 2. The elixir didn't immobilize the recipient while it was fully absorbed. And 3. The memories from the elixir were integrated far more quickly and seamlessly than the queenly power. On the day she'd been chosen to become the fading queen's successor, the nearly transparent matriarch had summoned Avil to her boudoir, pressed both palms to her breast, and passed the true magic into her body, where it had expanded and settled. Avil had been immobilized for several long minutes, unable to speak or move, while her consort, Vlaine, stood at her side, guarding her during that period of vulnerability. She'd had to acquaint herself with her newfound power. Young queens were not powerful queens. Time was necessary to sort through and study the many legends, myths, and magic at her disposal. It had been human decades before she'd come into her own. The elixir worked quite differently. She'd thought her memories had been stolen. They hadn't. They'd been faded to mere shadows without substance, outlines with no content, and as the golden liquid permeated her essence, those shadows solidified, took shape, and became accessible again. Perhaps because she'd once known the memories, each and every one, they were easier to absorb than foreign, heretofore unknown facts. There was no sudden rigidity, as an enormous amount of information was reanimated in her consciousness. No sense of being accosted or overwhelmed. On the contrary, she felt made whole again, at peace in a way she'd not known in her entire existence as a Fae, as if she'd been walking around with her most important parts amputated. Then suddenly they were restored, melding effortlessly back into her body again. Fire to his ice. Frost to her flame. No, she had no desire to see those memories yet. She wanted her origins first. She wanted to access that time in her life before he'd come into it, the carefree wild years, during which the memory, secreted in the king's towering silver, had told her she'd been happy and free. Ah, there she was. Zara. Witch and healer, connected to all, chestnut-skinned and barefoot, she raced across a field of flowers toward her home. Her hair was long, dark, spiraling in glossy curls to her waist. Her eyes flashed with ebony fire, and her short shift was the many bold colors of Tamura wings. The tattoos of her clan curved up her legs, fanned across her shoulders and down her spine. She had family. 4 generations beneath a simple, yet expansive roof. Grandparents and parents,
siblings and nieces, though no children of her own. Although mortal, they were a long-lived people, surviving well into their 100th year. As the first memory the king had given her insinuated, she'd loved her life, known and treasured every inch of her small world. She'd even loved him. That she now knew without doubt. But her restored memories were absolutely identical to the true magic in a single, cruel way. She could visit and study each one, but she couldn't feel them at all. She'd acquired facts, void of context. It was like reading a human novel about a fictional character's life. It was why the Fae had no books, didn't write things down. They derived no sensation from reading. She had her answer. The loss of who she'd once been was permanent, because she had become Fae. Once she'd lived vibrantly. Now she could only do the equivalent of read about it, and wonder how such passion had felt. Knowing that she'd had it, and never would again. What point was there in the king pushing her to restore her memory? She could never be Zara. Never be the woman he'd loved to distraction and destruction. That woman was gone. Dead. Could not be reanimated. As she'd feared, the Fae Queen, with or without the full complement of her memory, the end result was the same. "Bitterness," she said, and sighed.
"Ah, bitterness,"
the Temura perched on her shoulder agreed. 23. There's a bad moon on the rise. Jada. She erupted from the slipstream at top speed and nearly crashed into one of the pillars in the alcoved entrance of Baron's Books and Baubles. Reconvene at the bookstore, Barons had ordered before vanishing from Chester's. She'd raced through Dublin, faster than she ever managed to navigate the slipstream before, but Barons, Lore, and Fade still beat her there, and were pacing impatiently before the door. As she skidded to a halt inches from a column, Barons growled,
"About damn time."
She bristled. "It's not my fault you haven't taught me how to move as fast as you. Barons, we have to summon..."
"Don't say it,"
he hissed.
"Told you, we don't fucking need him."
"But we don't know where she's going. Plan we may have just gotten lucky was a total bust. That means his plan," she was careful not to say Cruz's name, "is back on the table."
"I know where the book is going,"
Baron said coolly.
"Fae fuck thought he was being clever. He wasn't. Come."
He whirled and stalked down the alley to the rear of BB&B. She loped to catch up, with Lore and Fade bringing up the rear. "Where?" she demanded. Barons tossed over his shoulder.
"Analyze. Sifting inside the place is impossible. The stones can't be sensed there. The quarters are too tight for an army. It's near enough that Cruz believed we could get there from Chester's before Mac would arrive there from Malusha's, an assumption he should never have made. And therein lies a way to summon the Seely Queen."
Jada slapped the criteria up on her mental bulletin board.
"Substitute concubine for Seely Queen,"
Barons suggested. She hissed, disgusted she hadn't riddled it out sooner. "The White Mansion."
"Refine further. Where?"
She rapidly sorted through everything she'd learned about the place during her brief sojourn inside with Christian, came up empty-handed, and told him irritably, "I've not seen enough of the mansion to isolate a preference for any one location over another." Baron said,
"Even if you had, you don't think like a man. Were I the Unseely King who'd built an infinite house for my woman, I wouldn't want to have to go looking for her every bloody time I wanted to see her. I'd have a way to summon her, and I know where I'd want her. The book is headed for the concubine's bedchamber."
Then they were at the brick wall, behind the bookstore, at the very spot she'd once made the decision that had cost her 5.5 years of her life. He kept calling her the Queen. "So I was thinking it had to be somewhere in Faerie," Jada groused. Cruz had been doing it deliberately to mislead, and it had been effective.
I made select comments to which he responded, yielding more information than he'd intended.
Baron said.
He needs us. He can't touch the spear. He can't kill the queen. Withholding information was his only leverage.
We can't afford to be wrong.
I spoke with Alina, while waiting for you. She confirmed the Shisadu's presence at this precise spot mere minutes ago.
Does she know what she's sensing is Mac?
No, and I didn't tell her. Every second counts. Move.
He surged into the silver concealed in a brick wall and vanished. Squaring her shoulders, Jada leapt in after him. A partially eaten rhino boy lay on the floor in the white room, keening and gnashing his tusks, clutching the oozing stump of an arm.
She's rebuilding her strength,
Lore said grimly.
Leaping over the savaged Unseelie, Jada dashed into the next silver after Barons with Fade and Lore close behind. A chill of deja vu kissed her spine. But now was no time for memories of the day 14-year-old Danny had leapt so fearlessly and blindly into one of these very silvers, only to end up adrift in the Hall of All Days. Nor was it time for memories of the afternoon she'd entered one of the silvers with Christian, and loosed the Crimson Hag on the world. After years of having to leap into whichever ones she'd been lucky enough to find, discovering the hard way where they led, she harbored a special hatred for the silvers. As they raced into the White Mansion, down dazzling alabaster corridors with high arched ceilings and tall sparkling windows that framed a snowy garden, an ice-crusted maze, Barons opened the pouch he carried and tossed one of the stones over his shoulder for Lore to catch. The tall, muscular blonde palmed it and slipped it into his leather jacket. White marble floors turned to sunny yellow, rose to turquoise, then bronze as they moved deeper into the infinite, ever-changing White Mansion. You do know where you're going, right? Jada demanded, catching the cool blue-black stone Barons tossed her and tucking it into the outer pocket of her backpack.
Inasmuch as anyone can ever know where the fuck they're going in here,
Barons growled.
Mac has no more certain sense of direction in here than we do. Look for crimson floors. They lead to black, then to the boudoir.
He tossed the fourth stone over his shoulder to Fade, who was bringing up the rear. There was a sudden commotion behind them. Vicious snarls met with cool laughter. She skidded to a halt, whirling. Cruz stood behind her, encased in a shell of translucent, shimmering walls, clutching the fourth blue-black stone in an upraised fist, while Fade flung himself repeatedly against the barrier, with no result. The Unseelie prince smiled at them icily.
Going somewhere?
24. I follow the sorrow song of the moon. Avil. There was no escape from the king side of the boudoir either. The nearly invisible towering door, set into the smooth black walls of his bedchamber, failed to respond to her imperious command. Nor did any of her magic affect it. She was as trapped on his side as she'd been on her own. She snorted. He'd always held on to her too tightly. That had been precisely the problem. Everything had to be his way. She'd loved him when she first met him. She'd loved him still at the end. But she'd realized love wasn't enough. It was possible to love someone who was completely wrong for you. You could waste your entire life loving that person, doing enormous damage to each other and to the world around you. She'd never wanted to live in his cage, but she'd done it for him, hoping he would one day give up his mad quest to turn her fey and be happy with what they had, hoping he might eventually return to her world with her. All those eons he'd worked alone, while she slept alone, they might have been living, loving, creating. At first, upon installing her in the exquisite White Mansion, he'd spent every night in her arms, anywhere and everywhere, in her bed, in his, sprawled in one of the eccentric tower rooms that opened to the sky, counting stars between kisses,
on the floor of her closet, atop an enormous grand piano. They'd splashed their love from end to end of the ever-changing, ever-growing mansion, while she'd drunk the nectar of galaxies from his lips, tasted infinity in his arms, and decided it might not be so bad to live forever, as long as she was with him. At first they had no time for anything but each other. Their love had blazed like a supernova. But darkness began to eat away at their light. A silent, seething fixation had been born in him the day the Queen refused his request to turn Zara Fae. Over the eons, he'd begun spending nights with her less frequently, working endlessly in his laboratories, birthing the children of his court of shadows in an attempt to recreate the song. One day, she realized she hadn't seen him in months, then years. She'd spent the time gathering seedlings and young plants, and, although by then he'd given her trinkets with which she could create any number of fabulous illusions, she'd nurtured and grown her lush, aromatic gardens in the old real way. She'd begun playing with the small creatures of the forest, tending their occasional injuries, taking pleasure in the beauties of nature that abounded in her realm. Alone. So damned alone. Missing her family, the bustle of so many comings and goings, the din of noise and laughter beneath their roof. Between his visits, he'd send her gifts with which to amuse herself. Pretty baubles, fabulous jewels, and opulent gowns. She'd had rooms and rooms of clothing and shoes, cabinets filled with magnificent jewels, and nothing but time to walk around looking at them all. No one for whom to wear them. With each increasingly lavish gift or object of power he sent, some, like the amulet, intended to make her more equal to him in power, she'd begun to think he'd never seen her at all. Or if he had, he didn't think she was good enough for him. Otherwise, he'd see she didn't want power. He'd stop trying to turn her into something she wasn't. But she'd turned anyway. The longer she stayed inside her portion of his fey realms, the paler she grew, her dark skin lightening, her ebony curls fading, until, in time, although she'd not been fey, she began to look like one. The day finally came that she understood his quest to recreate the Song of Making had nothing to do with her, and everything to do with him. The Seelie Queen had denied him something. The arrogant God-King, who was capable of such great tenderness and passion, was also capable of great obsession. But it wasn't with her. It was with proving the Seelie Queen wrong. It was with refusing to accept no for an answer. He would have the song, and he would turn his concubine Fae, no matter the price, and he would never rest until it was done. After he'd created his court of shadows, and brought his favored son, Cruz, into existence, she'd seen even less of him and more of Cruz as the king began dispatching his prince to bring her potions. Cruz became her companion, confidant, and friend. He would have been her lover, yet Zara's heart still belonged to her king. One day she'd simply had enough. She'd not seen her king for so long, she could not even recall how much time had passed since his last visit. The details of his face had grown blurry in her mind. On that day, she asked Cruz for a favor, and he granted it. It hadn't turned out as she'd planned. Cruz had been, after all, his father's son, subjugating her wishes to pursue his own. Avil stiffened and withdrew hastily from her memories, shaking herself to crack the thin sheeting of ice that encased her. There was an intruder in her mansion. She could feel it approaching, sense the violence and disturbance. The White Mansion was a place of beauty, peace, and serenity, and did not like this entity within its walls. On her shoulder, the Temura shifted with sudden tension, peering this way and that, pecking at air. She pressed a hand to her throat, expanding her senses, reaching out to taste and touch what came her way, to fathom the ways her future might unfold. The Shisa Du was here. bringing into these hallowed walls the very worst of the king himself. Hunger for power, bottomless need for stimulation, and whatever dim sensation it might enjoy. It drew nearer with each passing moment, hurrying straight for her. She knew why. She'd passed eons in a court of incessant treachery and betrayal. The queen always had to watch her back. There was always one among the royals that coveted her crown. Ironic that the result of the king's act of atonement for the wrong he'd done her might now kill her. He'd made the Shisa do out of grief at having lost her, and now his book wanted her dead. The king's love was a gift that just never stopped giving. A bitter smile curved her lips, the Fae and their endless quests for power. Now that she had her memory back, so many things made sense to her that had puzzled her as queen. She suspected that since her memories had never been actually gone, merely stripped of their vibrancy to the point of inaccessibility, even as Oviel, she'd retained the defining characteristics and nature of Zara. She knew a Fae that tried to overthrow her once would eventually try again, despite wiping its memory with a cup from the cauldron. Humans had a saying, "An angry man is an angry drunk, a happy man is a happy drunk." The king had been wont to say it more simply. Can't eviscerate essential self, no matter how many times the Fae tried to. She finally understood her proclivity as Fae Queen to interfere with mortals, her predilection to protect them, her fascination with Adam, who'd abandon her incessantly to walk among mortals, even fallen in love with one of them, and chosen to give up his immortality for her. She knew now why she alone among the Fae could see human souls, why she'd slipped off more than once to a city in the mortal realm called Cincinnati to spy unseen, marveling at Adam's golden glow, feeling the shallowest impression of chafing dissatisfaction. Had she been capable of true emotion, she knew what it would have been. Envy. But she was getting lost in reverie again, and there was no time for it. Others were in her mansion, chasing the O'Connor possessed by the Shisa Du, the sentient embodiment of the king's act of contrition. He hadn't even gotten that right, and had been trying to clean up after that mess ever since. But for whatever reason, it seemed he'd changed his mind about containing it and making amends, or he'd be here now, stopping this fiasco before it happened, stepping in and saving her from paying the ultimate price for his mistakes, righting his many grievous wrongs. Didn't he know she'd drunk from the flask, had her memory restored? Didn't he know she knew the truth now? All of it? She shattered the ice that coated her, and expanded her senses, but couldn't feel him hovering nearby. Then again, she had no idea if she'd ever been able to sense him, if he'd cared to keep himself hidden. In case he was there, concealed from her awareness, she spoke clearly, choosing her words with care. "I have my memory back. I left you by choice. I wrote you a note on a scroll I tied with a lock of my hair. I said, 'You have become a monster. There is nothing left of the man I love.' I wearied of waiting. You are incapable of sacrifice, and that made you incapable of love. Cruz offered to take me home, to my world, where I could live and die and return to the All. I wanted to escape what you'd become. Go home, and be Zara again. Pure small things like me don't fare well among gods. If you ever truly loved me, release me from your prison. My freedom is the only thing you have that I want. Let me go." The moment she finished speaking, she inhaled sharply and stiffened. The Shisa Du was here. 25. Of Our Elaborate Plans, The End. The Shisa Du. I hastened down the corridor to the boudoir. Although a confederacy of cretins, idiots, fools close in somewhere behind me, I pay them no heed. By the time they find their way across these ever-changing floors to the boudoir, it will be too late. I'll be gone. We are desire, lust, greed, and the path we choose to supremacy. My path to supremacy was masterfully planned and executed.